Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz, together with my colleague, Brendan Berry. We are both professors of law at WMU Cooley Law School, their Tampa Bay campus, and this is the Constitution Today. And I start the show every week with the following, and that is that the opinions that Brendan and I espouse during the course of this show are our opinions only. They are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of Cooley Law School or its faculty at large. And good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm sorry if the sound isn't all that good. I have to operate for my automobile today, but we'll be able to solve that problem in about 10 minutes. So what's going on with you, man?
Nothing much. Just enjoying another sunny Florida morning. It's kind of brisk here, but it's refreshing. So.
Oh, I'm telling you, it's time to go ice skating.
Yeah.
You know, it's 55 degrees outside.
Yeah, right.
Okay. I mean, you know, that we got people here that are just absolutely freezing to death. They've got their heavy winter coats out. And when you're around in certain areas, the mink coats are coming out.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, okay, 55 degrees, you know, what can I tell you? But it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, okay. Let me interrupt for just a moment. There was somebody on the line, but I guess they've hung up already. You must have given them the answer before they even asked the question.
Yeah. That's interesting. And, hey, I have a question for you, but I don't know what you're talking about, but I have a question for you anyway.
I
like that approach to life. In other words, I want to be first in line, and no matter what they're talking about, I got something to say. Okay?
Exactly.
Yeah. Jeff hasn't said anything anybody can disagree with yet. I mean, I'm sure he's going to say something.
Anyway.
He hung up because he knows that we now ask for their first name so that we can refer to them with respect. But I guess he didn't want to go there.
Yeah, okay. My name is not caller. My name is phone-in. I don't know. So, you know, I'm phoning it in too, folks. Let's just leave it that way.
We start,
you must know what I'm going to talk about now, too. We start every show with a segment that both Brendan and I do called What Do I Really Think? There is so much to talk about today that I'm going to try to keep this really brief. Yeah, that's really going to happen. I'm going to try to keep this really brief. It's a story that came out this morning about events that are yet to take place. But here's the way it goes. I'm a little disturbed over the actions of some of the people down in Georgia at this point, voting rights voting rights advocates, who are now announcing that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are coming down there today to speak about voting rights and their plan for a voting rights bill and their plan to do whatever is necessary to change the filibuster so that these voting rights plans can come through. And they're going to boycott this because they, quote, don't want to be part of another photo op. They want to see concrete plans for those two particular issues. Now, the president's speech has pretty much been released. What he's going to say has pretty much been released. They're getting exactly what they're asking for, okay? But they're going to boycott him anyway. And I just don't understand this. But what makes it even worse is that now Stacey Abrams has announced that she's not going to be there either, that she has a scheduling conflict. Really? The President of the United States is going to come down and talk about what is utmost in your mind and has been for years and supporting the things that you want to have happen, but you're too busy. Now, to me, when POTUS invites you, that's where you go. There is nothing more important than POTUS standing there promoting what you have been promoting all of your adult life.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Stacey. I know you're trying to walk a fine line here between alienating these voting rights organizations that you have brought together in a coalition and POTUS. But don't give some nebulous excuse that you have a scheduling conflict because you're running for governor of Georgia in an election that is almost a year away.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not buying it, okay? You have an obligation here. But let me tell you something. When you want Joe Biden's endorsement, you're going to be there, Johnny on the spot. You want his endorsement. You want his help. You want him down there in Georgia during the real campaign, but you're going to leave him, you're going to leave him sitting there and stand him up. Stacey, grow up. The world doesn't revolve around you. It did for a while, but at this point it doesn't revolve around you. And if you want to be governor of the state of Georgia, you start acting like somebody who really wants to be or expects to be governor of the state of Georgia. And that's what I really think.
All right. Well, my thoughts this morning are about what's going on in a couple different states, or more than a couple of states. A disturbing trend with disturbing historical antecedents. First of all, here in Florida, where Jeff and I where we live and work, the governor, Ron DeSantis, has proposed something called the Stop Woke Act, which is legislation intended to curb what is taught in schools. There are a number of different this all started, of course, over quote-unquote critical race theory, which, to my knowledge, has never been taught at the public school level. It's college-level stuff. And it's merely the idea that history should be taught through the lens of race relations and racism. Obviously, those are key parts of our history. Unpleasant as they may be, it's real and it's part of our history. There are forces in this country that don't want to deal with that part of our history, that want to deny that part of our history, that want to rid that part of our history from our consciousness or to turn it on its head. Now, there's also similar movements going on in other states. I want to talk about a Republican from Indiana named Scott Baldwin, who recently, during a hearing in a back and forth with a public school teacher, said, and incidentally, this guy Baldwin, his name has come up before. His name showed up on a list associating him with this group called the Oath Keepers, this right-wing fringe group. So it shouldn't be too surprising what his outlook is here. But here's a quote from him. Marxism, Nazism, fascism, I have no problem with the education system providing instruction on the existence of those isms, he said. But, quote, I believe that we've gone too far when we take a position. We need to be impartial. He then, of course, came under heavy fire, as he should, and had to backtrack on those comments. But the comments were in no way unclear as to what he was saying. He was saying that you can teach students that there was such a thing as Marxism, that there was such a thing as Nazism, that there was such a thing as fascism, but you may not take a position on it. You may not condemn it. We talk a lot on here about, false equivalence and both sides-ism. But here, this is heading in a dangerous direction. The Florida law that I was talking about, the quote-unquote Stop Woke Act, how cute is that, has some language in it that is really remarkable. I'm scrolling through here on a Washington Post article, and here's some of the language. A teacher quoted this back to the state senator. The bill that they were debating says educators cannot, quote, listen to the breadth of this language. Educators cannot, quote, affect the students' attitudes, habits, traits, opinions, beliefs, or feelings about, quote, divisive concepts. The laws being proposed in these states by Republicans would allow parents to sue teachers who do this, who affect students' attitudes, opinions, or beliefs or feelings about divisive concepts. Essentially, empowering any parent to sue any teacher who says anything that offends a student's sensibilities. And these are the people who are lecturing liberals about being snowflakes, right, and about needing safe spaces and all that. There are a couple of things to say about this. First of all, there are going to be legal challenges to these laws, and there should be. We have something called a First Amendment, which applies to state governments as well as the federal government. The government may not get in the business of telling people what to say or how to express themselves. There's no question that in this case that the chilling effect is going to be incalculable when it comes to what teachers are allowed to say in the classroom. So I'm gonna be very interested to see how this plays out constitutionally, whether teachers challenge the law, whether they challenge it on First Amendment grounds, and what federal courts will say about that. I'm seeing on social media, and I can't say that I have any statistics on this. This is anecdotal at this point. But you're seeing on social media many educators now talking about leaving, either getting out of the profession altogether or leaving Florida or Indiana, right, or whatever state is trying to impose these restrictions and make teachers liable for saying things that offend conservative sensibilities, like facts, you know, science and things like that. The other thing I'll say about it is not necessarily a legal point, but a historical one. When somebody like Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, decides that he is going to take over the curriculum, he talks in bizarre language about, quote-unquote, ideas being smuggled. He calls it smuggling. Ideas being smuggled into public schools. I don't know who is the smuggler here or what world he's living in, but to my knowledge and according to what I've read from education experts, the curriculum is something that is developed by the state legislature, by the State Department of Education. All these people are at the table, by educators, by teachers. What Ron DeSantis wants to do is start a war between teachers and parents. He wants to take control of the curriculum away from teachers and turn it over to parents. Of course, the kinds of parents he prefers, with the kind of ideology he prefers. He's using us, the education of our children to divide, and he's inventing problems that don't exist. There is no such thing as critical race theory being taught in a public school. It is an issue that does not exist. There is no liberal bias when it comes to ideas like Nazism and fascism and Marxism, whatever ism you want to talk about. It's not a bias to condemn that and to let students know here's what fascism looks like. Here are the markers of fascism. here's what you need to look out for. And when you see this, you need to know what it means. And one of the markers of fascism is a takeover of the curriculum and a whitewashing of history. You know, you can see why. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the real issue here is, and I don't know how far reaching this statute is, I'd have to read it. But what really is in jeopardy is even more than what you see in the elementary schools. You also have to take a look at the fact that we have a state educational system in colleges. And the question now will come in is, does now the governor have the power to say that certain courses will not be taught in public colleges? Are we going to rewrite history by removing certain things from the curriculum in a college, where a college wants to teach world history or wants to teach political science or wants to teach a course on the rise and fall of the Third Reich or wants to teach a course on the Cold War against the so-called communist countries? And now we're going to say that you're not allowed to teach that and be critical of the things that were done by those particular isms. And I think that this is a real difficult issue. This comes to walking into libraries and burning books and saying these books say these things and you can't have them available to students. This is really a minority point of view, and it's a statute being passed by an overwhelming Republican legislature, by a governor who wants to be the president of Florida. He wants his own army, okay?
Right.
The president of Florida, who now is going to start going around and saying, we're going to go through the libraries and we're going to burn all these books. Our students don't need to know that fascism is bad. We want them to believe that fascism is good. We want them to believe in strongmen. We want them to do away with democracy. And the only way they can do that is not see what bad comes from Nazis. That's simple.
Right.
So I happen to agree with you. This is very dangerous stuff he's treading on. I think he is showing that he is a budding Mussolini, and he has to be put in his place. And I will be honest in telling you that Charlie Crist is a friend of mine. I want him to be the candidate against DeSantis, and I want him to speak out in just those terms. If he's going to go down DeSantis, I want him to go down fighting. I want him to go down telling people, this is what you're buying into. This man, all he needs is a penciled-in mustache, and there he is again. The haircut ain't that much different. And it's got to change. So this is a call to action that parents, okay, you've got to get out there and vote for school board people who will not give in to this type of bullying and will stand up and say, no, our curriculum includes everything that is truthful. And that really is what has to happen. So I agree with you. This is very dangerous stuff. Very, very dangerous stuff. So there is a subject matter that Brendan and I talked about this morning. As I always tell you in advance, most of this is it's not scripted, but we know what we want to talk about. We talked about the arguments that were made a week ago, or a little less than a week ago. Yeah, just about a week ago. Actually, it was a week ago. To SCOTUS, in regards to the masking mandate or the vaccine mandate that was put out by OSHA, that, in my opinion, a very conservative Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, who had consolidated all these different cases that had been filed, got it right when they said the answer is right in the title to the agency involved, and that's OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And we talked this morning about the arguments that took place and just what really is at risk here in all of this. And this is going to be kind of a lengthy conversation because the history of OSHA and the history of all administrative agencies goes back 90 years, almost 90 years. And we have to go all the way back to a period of time, the Great Depression, which is just a fancy title that people remember but don't know really what it's all about because we just don't talk about it anymore. And so just as a little history, I'm going to start out talking about this in terms of the history. During the start of the Great Depression in the early 30s, we saw in this country the rise of populism. We saw the rise of isolationism. We saw the rise of what amounted to be forms of fascism in this country. We don't talk about it. We don't say much about it, but it was there. And as a result, we found that the main attack that happened was eventually Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the American people saw through all of this. And once Roosevelt was elected, this trend really started to die. But what we saw during the Roosevelt administration was the rise of administrative agencies, agencies that were designed to create jobs, whether it was the WPA or some of the others. And surrounding all of this was also a rise in agencies that were born out of cabinet posts. And these cabinet posts took on additional responsibilities. Congress passed certain laws, gave them certain powers, and they moved forward with them. And as our government, especially after World War II, started to grow, our population became greater. The country became more homogenous. We found ourselves with a government that was so big and getting so big that Congress could not keep up with the needs of the people, the needs of the agencies, and what the people wanted these agencies to do. We formed the EPA. We formed OSHA. We formed the Housing and Urban Development agencies. All of these were authorized and delegated authorities given to them by Congress. And what do I mean by that? Congress has certain powers, and one of them is to delegate authority to other people to perform certain functions. And what they did is they said, we can't keep up with all of the needs and changes that take place. Congress and the political process are too cumbersome. So, for example, they founded OSHA. Let's just use OSHA. And they said, you will formulate rules and regulations for businesses to protect workers, whether it's the coal miners and black lung disease, whether it's what everybody knows about the asbestos problems. All of those things fell within OSHA's powers. Now, they didn't just say, hey, a bunch of people, you get together and formulate some rules and we're done. First of all, those rules, when passed properly, have the force and effect of a statute being passed by Congress. But there's a process that takes place. Unless it's an emergency like we have now, where OSHA acted in regards to COVID, they go through a rulemaking process, and they have to establish a record, and they have to establish exhibits, all kinds of documents and ability for Congress to review, because when they pass these rules, there are periods of time in which Congress can step forward and say, no, we don't approve that rule. If they fail to do that, it goes into effect. It has the force of statute. But Congress has to have a record as to why. Rather than create a whole new system of hearings, they hold a hearing, but they have all of this information that has been already promulgated and made by the agency. In this particular case, it was an emergency, but that's the way it worked. This whole process of government, all of it, starting with the New Deal, has been is like a target on the back of the people of this country to be shot at by conservatives who want to decentralize the government and return us to the rich control everything. You're not going to interfere with business because business built this country, and if people get abused in the process, they get abused in the process. This has been the need and the want of the Republican Party for the last 90 years, and they've been unable to do it. What do we have now? We have a Supreme Court filled, and I'm going to call them what they are, political hacks born of Republican super conservatism, who, in my opinion, indicated in the argument in this case, in the OSHA case this week, that they are ready to dismantle our form of government. That they're going to do what the politicians couldn't do. They are going to dismantle the New Deal. They're going to dismantle this process of government that we have through administrative agencies. And that's their goal. Now, I'm going to let you jump in here, Brendan, and comment on some of this, and we'll further the discussion. But this is going to take some time.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's sort of the kind of thing that's, you know, when you teach constitutional law, this is kind of the dry part, right? Talking about the powers of Congress and the president and federalism and all that kind of stuff. And it's what's going on while people might be looking right elsewhere. I mean, while we're talking about what the court's going to do about abortion, which is mostly what the media is focusing on now. There are things afoot that the implications are going to be tremendous. Just to sort of add to your historical discussion, the Supreme Court early on in Franklin Roosevelt's administration was in the habit of striking down New Deal legislation. This can sound a little dry, but it's important. The Constitution has a list in it, in Article 1, Section 8, has a list of powers that Congress has. There are 18 numbered paragraphs that say Congress is allowed to do the following things. If it ain't on the list, then it ain't on the list, right? Congress has enumerated powers, limited powers, and the rest is reserved to states or to the people. The most sweeping power that Congress has is the power to regulate interstate commerce. That, of course, begs the question, what is interstate commerce? Because if it is interstate commerce, then Congress can regulate it. It says it right in the Constitution. And what the court was saying early in the FDR administration was that things like child labor, and working conditions, wages, things like that, those do not constitute interstate commerce. So the court was taking a very narrow view of what commerce means. Commerce basically just means the shipment of goods or people across state lines. At that time, Franklin Roosevelt threatened to pack the court because all of his legislation, obviously Congress was enacting his legislation, but he was proposing it, was being struck down in the courts. So he threatened to add a new justice for every existing justice who was over 70, which would have brought the number of justices to 15 at the time. Now, that didn't go over well politically, right? He did not succeed in that plan, but the message was sent. And suddenly we had what historians and lawyers call this the switch in time that saved nine, where the Supreme Court reversed itself. And its approach to what the national government was allowed to do. And here is language that we started to see from the Supreme Court, and it's language that to me makes very good sense. And I'm not sure why there is such a movement to undo it. But courts started saying things like, problems that are national in scope require a solution that is national in scope. And when you're talking about something like the Great Depression, that is not a local problem. The state of Michigan and the state of Florida and the state of New York and the state of Maine, they are not in a position individually to solve a problem at the state level that is not a problem that is state level in scope. The problem is national. And when you look at current events, I can't imagine a better example of a problem that is national, in fact, that is global in scope, than the COVID pandemic. Right? This is not a local problem in Florida or a local problem in Massachusetts or a local problem anywhere else. It is a national problem, and therefore it needs to be dealt with at the national level. And as you say, we have agencies to deal with problems like this at the national level, and OSHA is one of them. In a remarkable opinion, one circuit court, there's now a split among circuit and courts of appeals right below the Supreme Court on the OSHA mandate. And incidentally, we should probably clarify, this is the rule where if you employ a certain number of people, you either have to have them vaccinated or tested. Seems eminently reasonable. But that's the rule that the administration announced through OSHA. Now, in looking at the problem, and this is something, you know, you mix politics, law, cultural issues, you know, whatever. But I mean, one of the things that is frustrating for most rational people, most rational actors in this country and elsewhere, is the inability to get compliance with science, right? To get people to get vaccines. We are not getting out of this problem until we have, a national and even global solution. It's truly a matter of sink or swim together. We're going to see, though, as you suggest, whether the Supreme Court is going to start dragging us back into a time when it hamstrung any national attempt to deal with national economic or other types of problems. I was about to mention in one circuit court opinion, the court wrote that OSHA is there to handle things that deal with working conditions. They're not there to set health policy. A different circuit pointed out to that circuit in kind of a humorous footnote, you seem to have missed the title of the agency, which is Occupational Safety and Health. It is right, as you mentioned this, Jeff, it's right in the title of the agency. And yet you have judges who are willing to say, well, they're not there to make health policy. Well, yes, they are. They are there to make health, safety and health policy when it comes to the workplace. So that's my two cents or more. on that,
well,
but
bear
I...
Bear with me a moment before you go on. There's another caller that's calling in, so we'll find out what they want to say or ask the question. So let's bring
the
caller.
It's me, Ezzy. It's me.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Did
that.
You drop out?
Okay.
I dropped out, okay, and I heard the buzzing of your phone when I sent you a text message just now, Brendan.
Oh.
And if you look,
says,
tell Hezzy I was disconnected and I'm back now. Okay?
How am I supposed to look at my phone when I'm talking into it?
I understand. I don't know. Okay, you could be using a remote mic like me. I don't know. Okay, so, yeah, I heard everything you said, and I'm glad I didn't interrupt. I think that, by the way, when you describe the case, you also need to specify that they didn't say every single employer, that rule. Didn't say every employer has to have these mandates. It said companies that employ more than 100 people.
Right, right.
Because, one, it would have the greatest impact on workers. And number two, those are the people who generally, when they have that many employees, are associating among themselves and associating with others to the degree that, a, for example, a company that has COVID going around in it could become a super spreader event.
Mm-hmm.
And so they picked that reason. You know, I listened to the arguments the other day. And it had a process that was followed. And most of the court got caught up very early in vaccine issues. Okay? They were caught up in the facts of the case. Now, that is important to the extent, okay, to the extent that they have to decide, and the first issue is, whether there is a reasonable probability that the plaintiff will succeed on a trial. If the answer is yes, then you don't grant the stay. If the answer is no, then you grant the stay to maintain the status quo. Gorsuch brought up some major questions. And after they got through all the facts and they talked about vaccines and what difference is it going to make, and some of them were going, what difference is it going to make? Where is OSHA? Why is Biden trying to use OSHA as a mechanism to accomplish what he won't do directly? And he can't get through Congress. Gorsuch brought up a major issue, and that was, in other words, does OSHA or Congress decide the delegation of power properly in this particular case? Now, there's no question that the delegation of the authority by Congress has been attacked numerous times involving OSHA. And 9 times out of 10, the answer is, yeah, everything's cool. But here they're alleging that Biden is attempting to use OSHA to bypass Congress. The state of Ohio argued that OSHA has given powers that are too broad. Again, an attack basically on the idea of what OSHA is about. It's okay for OSHA to say that ladders have to have clips on them. And
right,
that's cool. Okay? But telling companies that they, to protect their workers, okay, and their industries, which may be important to the continued vitality of the country and the economy, that they have to have their workers vaccinated or wearing masks and tested, and there was a difference, it was masks or tested or vaccinated, so that their workforces will remain in place and the country benefits from that, that's an improper delegation.
Mm-hmm.
And continue to argue the Commerce Clause doesn't authorize health issues, strictly health issues. The state of Ohio argued that health means health as a result of accidents, not health as a result of disease. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Black lung disease wasn't an issue? You know, they come up with these, and basically that's we got to get rid of OSHA. And their argument was the states can take care of this on their own.
Right.
Like DeSantis, who wants to form his own Florida OSHA so that he can forbid certain regulations so that rich people can get richer. And that mandates are not part of their policymaking ability, and that this is an important issue that should be decided by Congress. Well, Congress did decide it by giving OSHA their powers. The arguments made by the opponents to this rulemaking really just centered around the states can do it, the states can do it, the states can do it, the states aren't going to do it, and basically trying to gut the power of OSHA as a matter of principle, as a matter of doctrine. And it's just the start.
Mm-hmm.
That's what bothers me. This is just the start of doing things like, I don't know, acting like DeSantis and having the federal government decide curriculum, the Department of Education. Or using federal money for parents to take their kids to private schools, like we've done in Florida, which has absolutely decimated the public schools. Or, I don't know, maybe the state should have their own departments of state and they should be able to run their own, even though it's right in the Constitution, run their own foreign policy. Maybe, as DeSantis wants, even though we're supposed to have provide, the Constitution says provide for the common defense, every state should have its own army, like DeSantis wants. Or maybe we'll do away with housing and urban development because the states can do their own stuff. And as a result of that, we don't need all these taxes to support all of this. The states will tax, except for in most states, governors want to cut taxes. So we end up without any of these regulations. We end up without any of these protections. This is going to be, depending on how this opinion is written and how they dance around these issues, the first fire shot by the Supreme Court in dismantling our form of government. Undoing what we have spent 90 years building because they are political hacks who believe in the Republican Party thought process of trickle-down economics and robber baron government. They just keep hacking away at everything they can possibly dismantle out of the federal government. And until the dead weight of them are gone, we're going to be fighting this battle. And they're not going to be gone for the next 30 to 40 years. Mm-hmm. Want to see our government change? All you got to do is file a lawsuit, and SCOTUS will say, yeah, you're right, that's too much power for the federal government. That's what I see coming. They never saw an agency that wasn't too powerful. And it starts with the Chief Justice and those who voted to decimate the Voting Rights Act. It was a shot across the bow.
Right.
It's a very disturbing trend.
Yeah, and it just you know, you just kind of shake your head thinking, what is the what is the end game here? You're talking about dismantling the federal, you know, regulatory state, if you will, and returning power to the states. Of course, Republicans are not fans of individual rights either, right? So, I mean, we're talking about racial equality, when you're talking about rights for LGBTQ people, when you're talking about religious freedom, or even, which can be regarded as freedom from religion, you know, they're very much on board with everybody complying with their own moral code, right? So they want to impose their own moral code at the state level. They abhor federal power because it reflects more. Right. Well, at the federal level, you can't get as much tribalism in. Right. I mean, I always thought that was one of the driving forces behind this impulse to empower states and dismantle the federal government is the impulse toward tribalism. Right. If we want to enact laws that reflect our own moral views, maybe our own religious views of the majority. You know, and we're in a small rural state, you know, then I want power at the state level. Okay, so I abhor federal level because it doesn't allow me to indulge all my tribal instincts. I also abhor individual rights because that means
there is an answer to that, yeah. Brendan. Breakdown in the federal system in those areas which regulate, as we put it, businesses, alternatives and things that they can do. A breakdown in all of this and returning it to the states allows for populism to grow.
Mm-hmm.
That is, populist governors like Greg Abbott or Ron DeSantis or others, what's her name up in South Dakota, those type of people then take over their states and basically create, for all intents and purposes, state dictatorships. And once they've done that and they have gotten the people used to the idea of strongmen, Huey Longs, for example, and I know most people don't even know what I mean by Huey Long, but Huey Long people, then at that point, the idea that one strongman can rise to power, supported by each of these individual governors and the people in their states who say, well, if it works for our state, it'll work for the federal government. And now all of those individual rights that they hate so much are decimated by a federal government that continually outlaws those individual rights. And it can become a mechanism under which we end up with a dictatorship and we end up with fascism. You can see the semblance of it in when a guy like Trump goes out there and picks and chooses who he wants to be the governor, who he wants to be the Secretary of State running elections, who he wants to be the legislators, who he wants to be the congressman, through a populist message, and learns the lesson that it was funny that last night, for the umpteenth time, and by the way, there's a special on tonight at 9 o'clock that I saw last night at 9 o'clock by Fareed Zakaria about, you know, the how to save American democracy. It was fabulous. And it was a history lesson of fascism, all of it. It was a history of fascism in the United States. And it showed how, and I've said this before, and I will say it 1,000 times so people understand. Hitler tried to take over the government of Germany in 1923 by force. He learned from that episode, you cannot defeat democracy by attacking it from outside and by force. You defeat democracy from within. You use democracy to defeat democracy. And so he started.
Hold on a second, guys. We'll finish your thought, and then there's a caller on the line. No problem.
Okay. And so that's how democracy died in the Weimar Republic in the 1930s. This is why people who are being called fascists don't like the comparison of Nazism to what's happening here in the United States. And it is identical. Everything that is happening is following that pattern. But they don't want people to know the history because they don't want to know the horror that follows. And the fact of the matter is the mere fact that Nazis were bad because they went after Jews and others and killed 6 million innocent people, that makes us not Nazis, does not mean you're not a Nazi. It just means that you picked other people, other boogeymen to go after, to create your populist message. And that's what's happening here. The Republicans learned through the Koch brothers, you don't take over the United States government by attacking the top. You go in from the bottom up. And that's how you take over. And that's what's important that's happening here. Go ahead. You had somebody
you
wanted to put
online.
Let's
see if we got that caller. Let's see what they have to ask. Get their name first. Bear with me.
I got 2 points.
Good morning, caller. You have
yeah,
a question you want to ask? Can you tell us your name, your first name?
My name is Pianchi. I'm calling from the South presently.
Huh? How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I, for self, and I'm an African-American, and I have a point of view. I myself want to have limited federal government, and especially these last two areas. OSHA in the vaccine. OSHA was never designed to do that. OSHA was supposed to protect the worker from the hazards of the workplace, not the workplace from the hazards of the worker.
Joe, can I ask you a question? We went through this with you once before. So could you please tell us what your question is, please?
Why are they trying to use OSHA like that? The second thing, I'm for school choice with vouchers, because shouldn't we have, parents have a right to put their child in the educational environment that they think is best for the overall long-term educational goals for that child?
There are your two questions. Hazi, he's asked his two questions. Hang on and we'll answer your questions. Okay?
Okay.
Is he?
Absolutely. We're going to hang on.
Okay. This is the way it works. You ask a question and we'll answer it. But this isn't an open forum for you to spout your views, okay? If that's what you want, if that's what you want to do, okay, all you have to do is contact Blog Talk Radio and buy your time, okay? And you can go on for an hour and say whatever you want to say, okay, just like we do. Okay, but we'll answer your question. The first question is, why did they do it through OSHA? Well, OSHA is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, okay? And the fact of the matter is, that they took actions to protect workers, all workers, but workers who work for large companies. No different than they created standards for coal miners to try to help prevent black lung disease. No more than they take action against the steel industry to stop certain practices to protect the health and safety of their workers. That is their mandate. If the mandate is not that, then the court's going to tell us that. But if it is that mandate, then it falls upon Congress to change the mandate to whatever they deem that it should be. But as of right now, this is their mandate. The allegation that it's being done as a backdoor way for the Biden administration to insert mandates on the entire country, it doesn't fit when you're taking only companies that employ more than 100 people. This is not a mandate for everybody in the United States to get vaccinated or wear a mask. So I think that your question is legitimate. I've answered your question. This is the second time, by the way, I've answered this question to you. We got into a row the last time with you. Okay. That's the first question. As it relates to, and we didn't even talk about, to a great extent, vouchers. I was just using vouchers as an example of something. I can answer that question in about 2 minutes. The answer very simply is that this country was built on public education. The greatest generation was publicly educated. Their children, my generation, the boomers, were educated on public education. The fall of public education started in the 1990s, and the effect of the fall of public education is readily apparent in the intelligent levels of the mass in this country. Their inability to read, their inability to write, and it fell because of things like vouchers, the inability or the willingness of states to cut educational budgets because it was easy to cut educational budgets, because rich people would be able to send their kids to private schools. Every dollar you take out of a public school is not just the dollar that's dedicated to the student who takes it. It's dedicated in an overall encompassment of how you budget all of the services and all of the things that school system is supposed to provide. And when you have a certain number of people take those dollars because, like, they're dedicated to their kid out of the public school system, you hurt every student in the public school system, and you promote educational idiocy. You promote type of citizens that we see now who are incapable of thinking, incapable of reading, incapable of writing, They can read the menu at McDonald's, and they can count change. And they look for somebody else to tell them what things mean. That's why voucher systems going to private schools is a travesty. And I hope that answers your question, Joe.
Yeah, I'll add just a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, as to OSHA, anybody who doesn't think COVID is an occupational or a workplace hazard should go talk to people who work at meatpacking plants.
Iowa meatpacking plants. They were the first place that were super spreaders.
Yes. And the primary hazard associated with going to work was you're going to get COVID. So I think there's a pretty obvious link there. I'd also add on the voucher point, we also have the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, which really should be called the Anti-Establishment Clause because it bars establishment of religion by the government. And I just wanted to throw that out there. There is now courts have upheld voucher programs in certain cases, but there is always a serious constitutional question when state money is being used to fund religious education. And, of course, most private schools are religious in nature, right? So
we have Betsy DeVos, our former Secretary of Education, who puts a lot of money in her own pocket because her family business is what they call charter schools. These charter schools that her family runs are nothing more than Christian madrasas. That's all they are. Okay? And they hire teachers for $15,000 a year and free education for their kids. And the education they give, they graduate students with A's who graduate from high school with a seventh grade education. And they go off to college and they flunk out. That's the kind of education they give. But their parents think their kids are getting great educations because they're getting straight A's. They hand them out like candy. They don't really get educated. And everything is Christian-oriented. This is more of the idea that white people have in this country, that this is a white Christian country, and we have to defend it against everybody who is different than we are. And that's where that attitude comes from in the educational process. So, okay. Now that I got riled up, I was being very logical, and now I'm getting riled up. This is great. I mean, my blood pressure is up at least 30 points. Okay? Okay. I'm going to go home and I'm going to take an enalapril and lie down for a while. I mean, it just seems like, maybe it's me, and I'll accept something, but every single one of our conversations always ends up in the same place. Education. It ends up in the same place. No matter what we talk about. It really is.
Yeah.
As an educator, okay, and Brendan is an educator, we see the results, okay, even in a law school, we see the results of the education that these kids get in public schools. I have to look at some of these people and say, you are truly a product of the Florida public school educational system. There's no issue. I can pick you out of a crowd, okay? Okay. I know that sounds terrible, but if Brendan knows I do that, he's heard me do it. Okay. You're just a product. I got it. Okay. There's no question about it. Run, Chip, run. I got it. Okay. I can't help it. Okay. And so therefore my attitude is, and I'm not saying this about Joe. Joe is who our caller. He really did, he had points that he wanted to make, and we let him make them the last time. okay? But I wasn't going to sit into the same stuff again, okay? And I was going to answer his questions. And his questions were legitimate, and I gave my answer, okay? If he has a different thought, he can buy an hour on Block Talk Radio and talk to people about how crazy I am, okay? And that works, okay? That's fine, okay? But, you know, that's, you know, I got it, you know, no. See, I got myself worked up again. I can't even get myself calmed down. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm trying to be funny, and I'm not getting there. So.
No, you're okay. Well, listen, we have to go on to our next guest.
You do. Okay.
As always, a pleasure. Always a pleasure. You just get home safely.
Happy to be here.
I will. Yep. Have a wonderful week, Hezzy. And whoever your next caller is, I'm sorry. I know you have to live this down. Okay?
No, I don't think so. I'm on target. I'm on the same plane that you're in, so no problem.
Okay.
Not the one that's the other one.
All right.
All right.
Take care, gentlemen.
Sounds good.
Take care,
Hezzy. Have a good week.
It's always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, let's see. We've got another caller coming in now. Let's pull that in. Good morning, caller.
Hezzy, this is Michael.
How are you? I didn't realize it. I'm so glad that you called. How are you feeling, Mr. Letts? What a pleasure. We should tell people that you're based in Columbia, South Carolina, and you're a police chaplain. And the thing that I got to know you about first would not be your chaplaincy, but the fact that you put together this 501c3 charity, and you buy vests for police officers that can stop a bullet. And we're not talking, buying a shirt. You know, these are expensive items, but you do it for police departments throughout the country. You know, another 5 years of this, then you might be doing this on the world stage. You never know.
I'm doing well. We're getting requests from all over the world. It's amazing.
Really?
And, of course, never has there been a time in history where we needed more restoration of law and order than there is now. So it's going to be an interesting ride in the days ahead.
Well,
I'm doing great.
It's
cold out here, but other than that, this is South Carolina. It is 45 degrees, so.
It's very cold.
I can only imagine what you're doing.
Well, we're in the teens. We're like under 20 degrees in the New York area, which is really quite cold. No, I think actually through the night it was like down to 13 degrees.
Wow.
But, you know, thank goodness there's heating. So we're very lucky. Otherwise, I think I'd be frozen by this morning. I want to ask you, what particular subject did you want to talk about today? Anything in particular on your mind?
Well, I would say this. One, continue to talk about, you know, there are a number of different topics, but the psychological aspects with our first responders. You know, tragically, just last week, we had a couple. It was a female deputy and a male deputy in Florida, Pinellas County, Florida, who have a one-month-old child, and they both committed suicide last week and left the child parentless.
God.
And
the reason why
I stress that to your listeners is they're both cops. They weren't new cops. They were young, but they had been on the force for a couple of years anyway, but it just kind of
realized. And it was their child? It was their child.
Uh-huh. One-month-old child. Mm-hmm. I just want to kind of stress, as we go into 2022, yes, we are doing all we can to make sure they are physically protected. But, you know, the stress of the job has gotten just so out of hand and so tough for officers on the street that they are human. They do have emotions, and sometimes they're overwhelmed and don't know how to get help. And, the tragedy ends up as we just described a minute ago, and that's just sad for the poor little child. That's sad for their parents and sad for the community.
Well, evidently, this is another aspect of police departments, not in any particular place, but I guess as an overall thing, it's a problem for the police departments because they're not really managing the health. And shouldn't they actually be seeing a doctor at the police department to see how their health is standing up? And why are they afraid to actually go and talk to the sergeants or whomever's in charge or the police commissioner and say, hey, I need a little bit of help? Or is that a problem internally?
It is a problem internally. Let me tell you just kind of what I wanted to spend just a few minutes of your show talking about this morning.
Sure.
And talking about to all of your listeners is the importance. We have talked over the last few weeks, so the importance of our first responders, our law enforcement, and our firefighters, et cetera, being there on the job to protect, to defend, and just the difficulty that they have on the job with outside people saying they shouldn't be funded, defund the police, don't give them protection, don't give them the ability to make their own choices, et cetera, pay them very little. But I just want to stress to your listeners that all of that has a psychological consequence on officers as well. And here's the ironic thing. In first responders, they screen more on just making sure you can do the job. We don't really take into account the psychological and the emotional effect on the
officer. Yeah, but you know, like, let me just stop you there. I understand what you're saying, that the police officers, whoever they may be, whether it be female or male, they're out there to do the job. But isn't it also the responsibility of a police department and the hierarchy in the police department to make sure that nobody feels that they aren't man enough or woman enough to do the job because of the pressure that they get in the real world? And shouldn't they be aren't we doing it? You know, it's more deleterious to be hurt by the people that you work with than it is by people on the outside.
I agree.
I'm blown away by what you're telling me.
And here is an aspect that I am seeking the help of all your listeners to help us accomplish. And that is this. Let me tell you how we got to this point so that people will understand how did we get here. Because once you understand how we get here, then you can figure out how we can help get to the next stage or how to solve the problem. Over the years, it's the same thing that happened in the public education system. Officers, I'm not talking about officers, I'm talking about chiefs, sheriffs, et cetera, begin to get pressure from a few minor people, I'll say minority people. That's not talking about their skin color, that's just talking about the numbers. Well, the minority of people that said, look, you shouldn't have anything to do with religion in your department. You shouldn't have police chaplains. You shouldn't have, especially in the olden days, they actually used to hire police chaplains. Every agency had chaplains on staff that would help these officers.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Well, they begin to get pressure with this.
Well,
and so what happened is...
You know, I can't accept this. I don't understand where this is coming from. Because at the end of the day, like I cover the city of Yonkers. It's the third largest city in the state of New York. But it's only about 320,000 people. So it's not like it's so big. But, you know, when you compare it to New York with I don't know how many millions are there, and then Buffalo, which is about 350,000. So we're in third spot. But the thing is, we've got a chaplain, and their job is really to reach out to people. And I remember the last commissioner, I don't know how this one is doing, but the last commissioner deflated any reason why you could knock on his door and speak to him and not feel that you're less of a police officer, less of a man, less of a woman, because you were stressed out by circumstances, by having to go and try to rationalize between a husband and a wife who are at each other's throat. Those are probably the most precarious situations for any police officer to attend.
We don't
even have the training for that.
No,
everybody talks about it as if you could send any fool to take care of it. No, you can't. You need special work. So, and
exactly.
just because I don't believe in a particular house of worship that's represented by a chaplain or an imam or a Jew, doesn't mean that I don't believe that because of their religious fervor and religious interests and religious beliefs that I should disbelieve them. I don't do that.
Exactly.
Maybe my parents
exactly.
raised me right. I have respect for religious. To be honest with you, that's one of the reasons that we are the way we are today. No ethics, no standards.
That's exactly right.
I don't know how America lost that.
Well, we've got to get it back, and that's the point I'm making. It's bled over into first responders to where, first of all, as I mentioned, we used to actually have paid chaplains. That's very rare anymore. But then they begin to just kind of disassociate from not even having chaplains, period. That's not that they went out and said, give me your chaplain's badge.
Well,
we
evidently don't have enough money to buy our police officers' vests, because that's what
right.
you're doing.
So we don't have enough money to
pay for a chaplain. What's wrong with us? What are we doing?
I agree. You're exactly right. And that's the point I'm wanting to stress to your listeners is, look, there are resources. And here's if we could encourage all of our command staff with law enforcement across the country, our guys and gals on the street need emotional, psychological support. There are plenty of pastors who would be happy to donate an hour or two a week, whatever it might be, to make sure that they can come by and spend time with the station, people answer any questions that may come up during the station, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
But that's not being actively encouraged right now. We need to get our police command staff to actually encourage and reach out to houses of worship saying, look, you are welcome here, and you are welcome to come by and spend an hour or two just meeting with the guys and the gals. Just let them know that you're available.
Yeah.
Because if we don't do that right now, it is getting so difficult. And they have no place to turn that they're committing suicide instead. Suicide is one of the highest rates of officers in the country.
Yeah, but who's at fault here? Is it the chaplains that are not reaching out to a police department and recognizing that they need help too? Aren't they human beings?
I think you're right.
Under the Lord, are they not regarded as just a human being?
That is
correct.
Or do we think less of them? No, and one of the things that I would stress to the listeners in the show is that all houses of worship have ministries, okay, you know, where they support missionaries,
right.
et cetera, et cetera. I would encourage them to say, look, one of the ministries that we need to support, especially in these times and days, is crucial, is our first responders. So I agree with you. They don't need to wait on a call from a police station, fire station. They need to go by and say, look, here's my credentials.
Yeah.
I'm available. If I can come by, you know, your shift changes, and just be there during the shift change so they can see my face, get my
mm-hmm.
card and say, no, you know, if there's anything on your mind, you just want to talk. There's nothing wrong with that. And have the command staff back that up. We encourage you. Take their cards. We encourage you to call. We'll give you the time, you know, an hour off to go make a good appointment.
Well, I mean,
you know,
it's all nice and good to talk about it, but then it's up to the department itself to reach out. Evidently, the priests or the clergy, they don't feel comfortable, you know, going to a police department and saying, hey, where's the commissioner? Let me sit down and talk to him or her. And get on with it. They know that there's trouble. Don't they read the newspapers? They're not illiterate. These are learned people.
Well, and there's responsibility on both sides. You're exactly right. I believe the houses of worship should be reaching out to the first responders. And I believe the first responder command staff should be reaching out to the houses of worship. Really, quite frankly, down the road, they ought to be able to budget positions where they have full-time people on staff that could be there 24/7 to make sure these people are ministered to. But what I'm trying to make sure your listeners recognize is it's not just officers being shot and killed in the line of duty. It has gotten to the point we have officers taking their own lives because they don't know how to deal with the stress of the situation. And we've got to do better to provide them the resources to be able to take care of themselves as well.
Well, I thought there used to be, maybe this is too many years ago, maybe close to 20, a little bit over 20 years ago, I knew that there were police departments and that they had a doctor on staff. I mean, literally, I was talking about a shrink. You know, we're talking about psychiatrists.
Those are the old days.
You don't
find that very much. Unfortunately, both of us are. You don't find that very often anymore. They are struggling.
It really is wrong.
It is. And I guess what I appreciate you saying, and the thing we've just been talking about, is we've got to change the mindset among the American people that, look, first responders are a valuable asset. We all recognize that statement. But we have to put feet to our words. We have to show them they're valuable by making sure they have the equipment they need, making sure they have the emotional, psychological support personnel that they need. Uh-huh. Otherwise, the thin line will collapse, and when it collapses, you won't be able to rebuild it.
I thought there, you know, maybe we really, you know, what you're telling me about today is really unnerving, because it shows to me that based on the fact that, because you and I are not playing games here, this is not a question of concocting a story, but the point is that we are evidently failing each other. Where's society? Where's our community?
Well,
this is not community.
And that was what I wanted to stress today in our discussion today, is we have got to do more. And I really feel like there are a majority of people who want to do more, but first of all, they don't know there's a problem. So we're making sure we're addressing that today. There is a problem, folks. Listen up and listen carefully. And the second thing is, well, what do we do about it? Well, right now I'm giving you a solution that is very effective, that doesn't cost anybody anything. You have pastors attempting to provide ministry to the community anyway. We've just got to connect the worship community, the houses of worship, with our first responder community and integrate those and make them feel comfortable to be able to reach out and support each other currently. And then if that's not enough down the road, we'll figure it out later.
Well, I think it's easy. I mean, there's got to be a mayor or some high person in any community, whether it's 10,000 people or 50,000 people or even 200,000 people. You could reach out to the archdiocese. You could reach out to the different religious groups that are out there and say, hey, we need you here. And our people are suffering, and we need charity from a religious perspective. We're missing it.
We do.
We need that strength.
We are missing it.
We can't do it.
And what I'm asking for, you're correct, and what I'm asking for on your show is that those who can garner some extra time, they need to be on the phone and wherever the area lives, and they need to do just what you said. They need to call the police chief. Do you have chaplains? How many do you have? Are you encouraging them to be utilized? And they need to make the same call. Mayor, how come you're not making sure that our first responders have a psychological support? When people bring these issues to the forefront, they get solved. But as long as we stick our head in the sand, and this is what happens quite often, I'm embarrassed to say this for first responders. There's a tragedy. There's a suicide. Everybody mourns. I can't believe I wish we would have said something about it. And then 2 weeks later, it's forgotten.
It happens again.
We cannot allow that to continue. We have got to get people in our community that are listening to this show today to say, look, I'll spend 10 minutes of time this week and call the mayor's office or call the diocese or call the commissioner's office and just raise the issue. Tell me what you're doing about it. And once people see the issue being raised, I believe we'll make tremendous progress across this country. But somebody has to trumpet the horn, shall we say, and we're doing that today.
It would be great if everybody who's a parishioner speak to their whoever the head of the church or mosque or synagogue is, or any other definition for their house of worship, and ask for help.
Exactly.
You know, maybe if it comes from the congregants, maybe then whoever's the head of that house of worship will, you know, say, hey, what a great idea. isn't that their purpose, to save souls? I thought that's what it used to be.
And
they need help.
I love the way you just put it. If it comes from the parishioners saying, what are we as a church doing to help our first responders? Wow, what a difference it'll make. Because it doesn't take long to get involved, to suddenly make calls, to bring about awareness to an issue, to get people excited about trying to provide a solution. I'm here sounding the alarm today. This is the first show I have done on this particular topic. Since it only happened over the weekend today, that enough is enough. I see officers commit suicide all the time across the country. But when you have a young couple, both the wife and the husband, who are both deputies, commit suicide together and leave a one-month-old child behind, we are failing. We are failing, and we've got to do better.
Absolutely. For two young people who have a child, and to leave that child without their being there, unbelievable. They made this child out of love. And that
correct.
They were so mentally stressed out that they couldn't go another day and bypass this whatever caused them to literally collapse mentally and emotionally.
And for them to not.
It's unbelievable.
Right, and they couldn't enough. You're exactly right. And for them to not feel like there was help available that they could have reached out to.
Probably couldn't even turn to their parents, so he'll probably
correct.
Alive if they're young enough.
And you look
no
at it
neighbors.
Correct. And this is what I'm stressing to your listeners, because the perception for first responders, and I'm not saying this is good or bad, I'm just saying the perception is they're superheroes. And superheroes don't have problems, remember, or any problems that they have, they quickly can overcome. That's just not accurate. They're humans. And they have emotions
rise
the same
to the
as everybody
occasion.
Else.
They correct. Rise to the occasion because of circumstances. That's their job. But then there's nobody there to take care of them after they've taken care of everybody else.
That is
you know,
correct.
They're out there, you know, upholding the law. They're out there fighting fires. They get sick, they get heart attacks, they get all kinds of things. They're just human beings doing exceptional work, and they're not even getting paid for it, and we're not even protecting them physically, and now it
right.
seems not even emotionally. Then what the
correct.
Hell are they going into police work for?
Which
they probably don't even know
problem.
What they're getting into.
You're correct, and that gets us to the issue that you and I have discussed before on your show. We are headed, folks, very quickly in the next couple of years to where there won't be enough people wearing a badge anymore. You won't be able to get the help that you depend on now, and that will be tragic for America.
You know, I don't know. You know, I hate to say it, but then, you know, if this is the type of work environment that the police officers have to work under, I would say they should all quit and get another job and you know what? Let America take care of itself at that point. We'll
that,
see how they like
me,
it.
We're almost at that situation now. It's,
I know we are.
When you're on the
I
inside,
know we are.
It's scary to see how fast we're going down that path. It really is.
Well, somehow we got to wake people
like,
up. I don't know if
right.
we don't have a large enough audience. To reach out to 100,000 or 200,000 people. But this is
the great
you know,
part about the audience is one person tell one person who may not be part of your audience.
Yeah,
one
exactly.
person tell another person. And we can solve this problem together as Americans, but we have to recognize we have a problem to solve and we've got to get on it pretty quick.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that was just one
oh,
of the issues.
Gosh.
There are plenty of other issues out there to talk about, but, you know, there are positive issues. Let me give your listeners, because I don't want us to be negative all the time. Let me give your
well,
issues.
We're not negative all
of...
the time. Do you think that we had any programs up to now that have been negative? I think they were quite positive, actually, if you must know.
Yeah, oh, no, I agree.
That we
started I want
these
to...
very important
no.
issues.
But I just wanted to...
You know what? If we paint
your
a rosy picture all the time, it's inappropriate because that's not balanced. We need to
you're
tell
right.
people the truth. And the truth is sometimes positive and sometimes negative and somewhere in between and sometimes off the rails. and off the tracks. It's better people get the complexity of it all, because they shouldn't think that Mary is fine and John is fine. No, they're not. And they're not
safe.
You're
exactly right. You're exactly right. And that's what I appreciate about your show. We can deal with complex issues, and because people need to know. You know, one of the things I was going to mention to you, talking on a very positive note, I just want them to understand everything that first responders do. We had a couple of incidents over the weekend. There was a department that discovered a dog in a fire that had puppies, and they were able to rescue the dog and the puppies, and since they had no place to go, every one of the officers adopted one of the puppies. So they've all got homes now, and it just goes to show you that, you know, these officers really...
But can
really,
we do that for people?
We can. If we put it the right way.
I know that dogs and cats are lovable, you know, but... Hey, we take care of fish better than we take care of each other.
We sure do. You're exactly right. We sure do. And but it's nice to know that the compassionate spirit is still there in America. We just have to highlight sometimes
more. Yeah, I think
it is.
Well, we need to – you know what's interesting is that we don't tell people what we think is right. And we don't await their telling us that they also agree. And maybe that's the problem. We're really not talking to one another anymore. I don't know what we're doing.
I think that's a big problem.
Because sometimes we need direction. You know, I'm always thankful. I'm no dummy and I'm no slouch. But I do know one thing that... Like, for example, only 2 days ago, I called up somebody and said, you know, I really don't know what to do about a particular situation. Do you have any suggestions? They gave me brilliant advice. I mean, it doesn't get better than that. But not everybody has an ability to call out to somebody.
Right, right.
So I was very lucky.
And you are. We need to keep that. I tell people this all the time. Keep in mind that we're all human. Everybody needs a hand. You may feel like you can't do anything at the moment, but you know what? It's the greatest therapy you can do is to take a look and help other people. And you quickly discover that perhaps the problems that you have may not have been as monumentous as you thought, and you may be refreshingly encouraged the fact that you could help somebody else navigate something that they thought was hopeless. And the same applies to our first responders. And that's what's so important for me, to make sure we get that point out.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very interesting. When we first got introduced to Jerry, it was very interesting. I thought you were just going to be somebody who created this 501c3 called Invest USA. I thought, well, that was nice. Then you turned out to be a chaplain. Then you turned out to be a very nice guy. And it turns out, and you just have such a vast intellect, emotional and mental, and you know, that's everything. We don't have a lot of people like you. That's what's
missing. Well, we don't have a lot of people like you. That's where I feel like I am so blessed, because one of the reasons that I will tell people the reasons for my success is being able to associate with so many people like yourselves. You know, if you just give people a chance, you'd be surprised at where they will lead you to.
Yeah, everybody
this,
does rise up if you give them a platform. That's very true. Exactly.
And I tell them this all the time, that, you know, I mean, hey, it is a we can all learn from each other. We can really do better in society. We have been so divisive. And there are things that need to be corrected. But if we work together, you will quickly see how well we solve the problems instead of continuing to point fingers and just lay blame without any solutions. We've got to change the way our nation looks at things.
Well,
and,
you know, it's very interesting because this is the sort of thing that probably needs, I don't know how eloquent I could be, but I think maybe over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to have to sit down and write an article about this, because this is the sort of thing that is a message that needs to be heard, and we should probably blow it out there in the whole country, because we're failing. This is no good.
We are, and it's unfortunate because we're failing when there is a solution, and it's a very easy and viable solution. People just need to listen
very
to
true.
Understand what's going on. It would be
very
different
true.
If we were, you know, if it was if we were trying, you and I, figure out how you and I could together get up to Mars. I mean, that's a pretty hard, hard task to do. This is not like that. This is a very solvable problem if we'll just focus for a minute and get the job done. And then our whole community life will be better because of it. I would encourage, as we're talking, for people to go to our website, investusa.org. And the reason why I put that in there is because we do have a Bless the Best program. So those that have heard what we were talking about earlier about the need for our chaplaincy system within our first responders can go there and follow some of those programs and help start something in their community and not just protect their lives physically but save their lives emotionally and psychologically and make a difference.
That's
and that's
good.
What it's all about.
Well, unfortunately, I didn't even realize it. I've overstepped my bounds, and our next call is already on the line. So we're going to have to talk about
today.
This again next week.
We
say
will.
That again?
We will.
Yeah, we
look
will.
Forward to it. God bless you. You have a great afternoon.
And God bless you back. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for all you do. Be well.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, bear with me one moment. I didn't realize it. We've got to call up Bob Marone, and so we'll catch him in a moment. Okay, that's not going through. Bear with me a second here. And okay, seems like we're having a little bit of difficulty at our end at this point, so we'll figure out what that is, what that's all about. In a moment, and we'll find out soon enough what it is. Okay. This is really weird because I've never had this before, so we'll find out soon enough what's going on. Huh. Okay. Oh, there we are. Good morning,
Good
Mr.
morning,
Marone.
Evan.
I'm sorry, I had some problems. Evidently, couldn't get out. I was trying to dial you. It didn't work. But anyway, it doesn't matter. That's all over. So, good morning, and how are you feeling today, Mr. Marone?
Good morning, Hezzy. I'm doing actually pretty well, all things considered. I even. I haven't used them yet, but I did go out and buy some of those testing devices, some of the short-term ones. So I was lucky. I was in a drugstore, and down by my daughter's, and I happened to be there the day that 2 days ago was when they made a delivery of a whole package of these things, and people were obviously waiting online for them. But I was already at the counter ready to buy something, and I just snatched one up. So I'm ahead of the game.
Well, hold on a second. I'm going to get back to what you were saying. Evidently, there's a caller, so we'll find out if they have a question for you. And bear with me a moment. Good morning, caller. Did you have any question for Mr. Marone? And what's your first name?
Hello, gentlemen. How are you guys doing?
Okay. How
I'm
are
Josh,
you?
I'm pretty good, actually. It's actually a very cold and very beautiful day over here in East Central Illinois. It just rained and then froze over, so there was an ice sheet on everything. So, no, it's a pretty good day.
Well, that's cool. Did you have a question for our guest today, or?
Yes, sir.
And what is that, sir?
Sir, are you a New Yorker?
Yes, I am.
Yes, I'm in New York. We both are.
Oh, okay. What do you guys think about the vaccine potential mandates, not necessarily from the federal level, but like companies imposing that on people? What do you guys think about that?
Well, I don't know if you're the host, if you want to handle it. I mean, I have an opinion on it, but and I'd be happy to share it.
If you want to share it, Bob, no problem.
I think that companies have a responsibility to all their employees, and it's a slippery slope for them. I mean, I understand why some people may feel that they don't like being told what to do, but this isn't a question about their own health. It's a question about all the other people that work there. So I think that a company has the right to ask for a mandate. That's my personal opinion. And I've done some volunteer work in vaccination clinics. I know the value of the vaccinations. But I do understand that it's a situation, for example, if someone is in the situation of where they can't take the vaccine because they have a pre-existing condition regarding their immune system, I think that the company should continue to pay those people. But for someone just arbitrarily saying, no, I won't take it, well, every company should have their own policy, and it should be up to them. But I do believe that people should honor that request, yes.
God bless you, sir. That's all the questions I had. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Be well.
Bye. That was interesting.
All right. Well, that, you know, it's an interesting question. You know, it's hard to know what's particularly right one way or the other.
I don't know, I don't want to get inoculated.
I think the real problem is not so much that people have a streak of independence, like don't tread on me and don't tell me what to do in America. And I can understand that. We recognize, for example, that if we're not inoculated, then why do we expect government to pay for our medical, our medical health and to take care of us and pay for the medical bills? And yet I understand nobody died from getting an inoculation.
That is correct. Well, I tell you what troubles me. In the very beginning of the pandemic, when I thought it was kind of like, remember the several years ago, the bird flu scare, heavy, I did not get an inoculation because the way I understood it, it wasn't a pandemic where I could give it to someone else. It was my risk to take. And if it's your risk to take, I understand that. And I say, you know what? Go ahead, knock yourself out. I do believe in that kind of freedom. But when it's the same thing like waiting for a red light or any of the other things that we do so that society, not socialism, quote unquote, with the bugaboo word on it, but most people who don't like socialism don't even understand it. But when you can make others sick or when your basis for it is political in nature, I can take a stand there. You're on the wrong side of the facts. You're on the wrong side of decency. You don't have a right to make someone else sick.
The problem is that a lot of people who do get sick, they're too embarrassed to own up to it. So they go around doing what they're doing, and they are sick, and they infect people. They don't necessarily wear the masks right. We also don't have masks that have a minimum requirement. You know, the crap, excuse the term, but that's what it is, the crap that we used to buy from China that are so flimsy, they could barely keep the smoke that comes from coal from your nose. Because I remember I traveled a good part of the world. I remember being in Istanbul, and you couldn't breathe without one of those masks. And because the dust was coming in, your nose would get clogged up. You couldn't even open your mouth without getting a burst of coal in your mouth or, you know, from the smoke from the coal that was being burned. We equivocate by not telling people exactly what it is. We make believe that it's good enough. Is it good enough for people to be wearing a scarf over their face? The answer is no.
No, and that's been clarified.
But we accept that as if it's okay. And you know what? Now, for example, they're going to allow for people to buy these tests that you're looking for, and it's going to be covered by health insurance. Well, that's wonderful, except that, why didn't they also then manufacture the type of masks that we should have had in the first? Why are we ordering them from China when it's crap?
My daughter's a microbiologist. And got me a kit in 95.
Why? She can't get it? She can't get it? Where does she live?
It's hard to get it. It's hard to get one of the top masks.
Why?
Well, I think your question answers itself. It's expensive to produce.
Because they're not distributing it when they should. It's ridiculous.
Yes. But I know when I do work at the clinic up in by Plains, they have us wear two masks and a shield, and a face shield, a clear shield.
Why is that?
That's eye protection. Well, because this virus and this particular brand, this Omicron, is very, very. It can go around the mask. It can go under the shield. It can go over it, and it's very catchy.
So do all the others.
But this one is easy to get. It's a lot easier to get than the others did.
Yeah, it is. It is more infectious than the others. Look, one of the problems too is the fact that our CDC equivocates with their message. Their language sucks. That's the best word I can use for it.
But I just wanted to go.
And we don't know what they're doing.
I wanted to go back to something for politics, and that's why I say the political nonsense. In fact, I caught myself answering the call. Both you and I, being fierce believers in freedom, we equivocated a little bit, as people should in this two-sided world we're now living in, this bifurcated world, if you're even on my side or not. Mm-hmm. We tried to be polite in saying, I could understand why you're concerned about your freedom. And that's why I got a little stronger towards the end of the call and didn't want to equivocate. For political reasons, our leaders equivocate all the time. They need to stop doing that. And they need to say, rightly, this is the red mask you need. This is what you should wear. We appreciate your willingness or your need to be free. That's what we're all about. But you don't have a right to hurt somebody else. Now, there have been people, Howard Stern, on his radio show, actually had one of his staff gather tapes of far-right people who went on the radio on calling shows and say, I frankly don't care who else I kill, who else gets it, so long as my freedom's protected. I'd rather be – that's insane.
Well, it might be insane, but the point is that's what they believe, and we can't change it. But what I do know is, and what we can change is, we could simply say, okay, you want to do what you want to do. We don't have the police to make sure that you're doing what you need to do, and we can't stop you on the street. We're not going to pass laws if you're not wearing a mask or you're wearing it under your nose because you think you're a wise ass. Well, fine, but we're not going to arrest you to do that, so you could do whatever you please. But what I do know is if you get sick, we're not taking you into the hospital because you never got inoculated. You can't prove that you got it. And we'll arrest you if you give us a false ID with regard to making believe that you did get it. We're not going to pay for your medical bill, and we're not going to give you anything else. So have a great day and do what you got to do. And you know what? And you know what they're doing in Europe? They're not saying, okay, you don't want it, and you're on disability or you're retired. We're going to take 15% of your disability because we're going to end up having to pay for your medical, God forbid you get sick. And if you don't, too bad. Take your inoculation because you're not getting inoculated. But that's the other thing, too. The CDC doesn't tell us that it's really safe. And they haven't proven all these issues to a lot of people who say, well, I'm not going to take it because it's going to cause me a problem or I'm going to die from it. I didn't hear anybody that died from it, from getting an inoculation.
No, nobody has died from it. And
over 800,000 people who didn't get inoculated died by not being inoculated when they caught the COVID. Why don't we stress those numbers?
I think they've given up. You know, we have another issue. And in fact, it's when
what?
I get back to when my radio station is finally rebuilt, Hezzy. I'm going to spend a great deal of time, at least I hope I will, although I'm very, 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 skeptical of the matter. Trying to explain to people that Donald Trump is as bona fide a traitor, not in the sense that he gave secrets to another country, but in violating the Constitution and violating his oath in such a profound way as we've not seen since, and worse than Aaron Burr when he tried to create a secessionist state in the South. And not because he did it per se. The issue that I have, and it's apropos to this, is no matter of truth, no matter of proof, no amount of hard evidence changes the minds of people who believe that Donald Trump was robbed of the election and that the insurrection was okay to do. You know, they've never taken out, they dress themselves in flags, but they have not read the 14th Amendment, Article 3. Anyone who reads it, and I would recommend that they go and read it now, will realize, oh, my God, Donald Trump. And again, you talked before about equivocating, being ambivalent. Well, finally, Biden speaking up, but he needs to be called the traitor that he is. The two things in this world that were too nice about hard facts when it comes to politics and religion. There are things about religion that ought not to be respected. It should be like sex and sexual preference. It's yours. Whatever you do at home is fine. Otherwise, I don't give a shit. It's about the law. And I am skeptical because it's not going to make a hill of beans. Many great newspapers, many great news outlets have said more eloquently than I ever could what I'm trying to say. The facts no longer matter. We have a president who, if a judge brought a decision that he didn't like, he referred to the judge's race or political party as a reason for it. If in any other time, in our lifetimes, Hezzy, ours, just ours, we're about the same age, we're months apart. If another president had pardoned people who were convicted of a crime, and the crime was doing the bidding of this president and covering up things that the president did, it would have been all by itself a national scandal. Never even comes up. And so
he's like a cult figure. He's a cult figure,
yeah,
and nobody's really saying very much against him. And
the truth won't matter, and that's what I worry about. You know, what am I just going to go on the radio and rant about it? I'm giving just a touch of the iceberg. But you know, people who do what we do, we really do the reading. You know, I've done all the research. I mean, this sounds terrible. I hate to make it about me, but I was a political science major. I understand the way it works. I understand how the tail wags the dog in American politics. You can't insult your base. But when your base is accepting such a bold lie so that they don't lose votes, it is the most reprehensible thing I've ever seen in my lifetime. It makes Richard Nixon look like a choir boy. Now, are there underlying things? Absolutely. Do I understand why the far right's fed up? Sure. The far left is just as bad. Look what's – I mean, all of a sudden, it's not a crime to commit a crime. How can a DA, as they're doing in New York City, how can a DA decide that X or Y is not going to be prosecuted largely because of the greater numbers of people who've been charged with these crimes are of a certain color, race, or creed or belief? The whole point of this country was it would be by the rules, not the color of your skin. And it needs to work both ways. Similarly, there are ways to teach history and not and accept the reality. You know, human beings, we on this planet, we're still prepubescent when it comes to organization and governing. We think we're at the pinnacle of knowledge, whereas we're only a few thousand years past the time when tribes evolved, and then tribes had to organize. And tribes organized, as you know, because it was instinctive. They looked for a leader. They took sides. They based more on loyalty and having what they did work be effective than whether or not it was right. And then it evolved into monarchies and kingdoms and because whether people like it or not, authoritarian governments are more effective at getting things done, but they're also more oppressive. So we evolved out of all of that. And we evolved, what are we going to do? We're going to cancel the Egyptians and the other people who enslaved the Jewish people for all the years that they did? Are we going to enslave all the different African tribes and enslave one another? Are we going to cancel the Indian tribes that massacred their fellow? In other words, we need to understand that that the body politic of this world and indeed this country did a lot of bad things and a lot of untoward things, and they were wrong-headed, and we need to grow up. But it doesn't mean, you know, it's like being on a couch and have the shrink say, I'm going to kill you because 30 years ago you left your mother at a bus stop. The United States as a people need to understand that we're still evolving. We don't need to go and condemn. I mean, we need to condemn the behavior. But where's the forgiveness? Where's the understanding? I mean, Great Britain, as you know so well. And by the way, folks, you're listening to a show that's run by a man who has dual citizenship. He's lived in Israel. He understands world history. And I'm talking about you, Hezzy. But people understand. Let's take Great Britain. Great Britain is one of the most successful countries on earth because their monarchy was effective. But look at what they did.
Right.
Look at what they did to the Scots. Look what they did to the Welsh. Look what they did to the Irish. Look what they did to the Indians. Mm-hmm. Look what they did here. Look what they did. And this, this, my friends on the far left won't like. They have left a legacy other than their colonialism, which was repressive. And which to some extent still today is high and mighty and class conscious. The countries that they've been, even though they should not have done it, have probably been better for it. Whether it's what we've inherited from their sets of laws. What they did do was wrong. So we need to understand that in a historical way and in an evolutionary way. And not hold up the past to some utopian set of ideals that doesn't even exist yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Reading the news every day is beginning to break my soul. But on the other hand, when we look at the left, they want to change the rules retroactively. That's why I'm a big Liz Cheney fan. I don't agree with about 60% of her politics, but at least she's willing to call the truth the truth. Well, you wanted me to come on. I got started. I'm sorry, Hezzy. But as you can
see, it's okay. I don't have a problem.
I've been greatly troubled by the last 4 years. The four years plus of covering Donald Trump. As an honest political talk show host who doesn't do shtick unless it's a deliberate comedy piece of shtick or a bit, it broke my heart. It broke my soul. And then the left response equally broke my soul. This country's in a lot of trouble, and I don't know if we're going to keep democracy.
Well, we're in a very precarious state of affairs, that's for sure. And, we have to resurrect our democracy or it's going to fail. And it looks like at the moment it's still very much in a crumbled state. And until
Absolutely.
We get resolved all these issues, the problem is that our discourse has been adversarial rather than based on fact. And the fact that we're now at the beginning stages of learning what happened on January 6th might actually inform us. And it had better be clear and concise. Otherwise, we're going to be in trouble because the whole democratic process that is the fabric of America's success is falling apart. And,
yes.
and it's divided a nation on every conceivable line of definition that divides us. So it's
yeah,
ethnic,
you can't get anyone.
Yeah.
You can't get anyone, has he, to acknowledge that the other side has a point, because both sides do. It's become either or. But the one thing that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime was a president not accept mm-hmm. An election. And then attempt to overthrow it. You'd be shocked. Most people don't realize that that is an insurrection, that that is an attempt to bring about a bloodless coup. And what it reminds me of, and I'm not
because
being high
because much of the main media hasn't done the job. They haven't explained it. They've been equivocating, and that's the point. And, yeah, there are maybe two, three, even five sides to every issue, but that hasn't been fully explained.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just not doing the job. And media has fallen down, and we've got opinion makers that are not always basing their opinion on fact. And
well, they're basing
it's just
it on
that.
Clicks and viewership.
Yeah.
You know, I
well,
was
the
more clicks
heroes of the world
being,
and all these people. Did you ever have the gall to call up somebody in Westchester County to say, well, I know better and I'm going to tell you what to do and you're not the elected official? I never did that. But, Hannity did, called up the president, told him what he thought was right. Who are
mm-hmm.
these people?
Well, the president needs those squawk box to define the narrative for him. That's how he used these people. I loved as a performer that Rush Limbaugh was so good at what he did. But for him to get the Medal of Freedom is not quite. I mean, what happened in, obviously, Germany was terrible. But after Goebbels died, no one gave him any medals. And Rush did. To the discussions in this country. Again, if you remember when he started, he was funny, his tongue was in his cheek. And I asked him at a conference once, and he was honest about it. Do you believe mm-hmm. everything you say? He said, my job is twofold, to get the highest possible ratings and then charge confiscatory rates for advertising.
Mm-hmm. True. Unfortunately, Bob, we're down to the last 50 seconds, so I have to say goodbye. So I can't wait till next week when we'll have a little bit more time to find out what to talk about.
Well, thank you very much, my friend, and it's always a pleasure. And by the way, I do need to say this before I go on my last 10 seconds. Hezzy Harris doesn't do that. It's why he's always being sued. But he tells the truth no matter what. You should be praised for it. Take care, my friend.
Well, thanks very much. You be well. Take care.
Bye.
There we are, folks. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Tomorrow's a Wednesday. Take care and be well. Goodbye. 1 second here. Got to get back to the studio screen. And we got 2 seconds. I don't know whatever happened to the studio screen. Here we are. Goodbye, and thank you.